Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jacob Moyer, BS, and Mark Tyson II, MD, MPH, about a real-world study investigating nadofaragene firadenovec in patients with BCG-unresponsive non-muscle-invasive bladder cancer. In our exclusive interview, Moyer and Tyson discussed the durable responses achieved with nadofaragene firadenovec in this patient population, the safety profile of this agent, the importance of pretreatment with antispasmodic medication, and the optimal patient population to receive nadofaragene firadenovec.
What was the rationale for conducting this real-world study, and how was it conducted?
Since nadofaragene firadenovec received FDA approval in December 2022, there's no published real-world data yet. So we presented at ASCO GU the first real-world data for FDA-defined BCG unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And we did that through a retrospective review of all of the patients treated at all three Mayo Clinic sites in Arizona, Rochester, and Florida. And that was between when the first dose was given outside of a clinical trial in November 2023 and December 2024, when we collected our last data for this project.
What were the key efficacy findings from the study that are important to note for your colleagues?
Yeah, so we had 46 patients who were treated. And of those 46 patients, three had pending post-treatment cystoscopy. So we had 43 efficacy evaluable patients. And of those 43 patients, 24 had carcinoma in situ with or without papillary disease. At 3 months, at first assessment, 79% of those CIS patients had complete response. And that was durable at 74% at 6 months and 60% at 9 months. In the papillary-only cohort of 19 patients, 3 month high-grade recurrence-free survival was, which was durable at 57% at 6 months and 40% at 9 months. And just with the caveat that the 6 and 9 months were Kaplan-Meier estimates, whereas the 3 month response rates were just simple percentages.
What were some of the key safety findings from the study?
So again, we had 46 patients who we could evaluate safety for. And what we mainly saw was many low-grade transient and local side effects that were managed in the clinic during treatment. We saw only 9% of patients with grade 3 adverse events, which was fatigue, fever, dizziness. But mostly we saw just bladder spasms, some leakage of the medication, and urgency. So pretty in line with the phase 3 trial. And 100% overall survival.
As nadofaragene is a newer drug, what's most important for doctors to know about its administration and use, and maybe any tidbits that you've learned, Dr. Tyson, in giving the drug?
The most important thing from my perspective in giving nadofaragene, and this may be true for lots of intravesical therapy, but bladder spasms and then subsequent loss of the medication is a real problem. And that's because it's $60,000 a dose or whatever it costs. It's one thing if you leak gemcitabine at $26 a dose. It's an entirely different kettle of fish to leak nadofaragene at $60,000 a dose. So I think perhaps one of the most important pieces of this whole equation is to make sure that the patients are appropriately treated with some type of antispasmodic. And we've gone through a number of iterations in our practice and have landed on rectal Valium. We give 10 milligram rectal Valium suppository about 15 minutes prior to the instillation. And we have some data that will hopefully be published in a couple of months showing that essentially eliminated the loss of the medication. Didn't quite eliminate it, but really drastic reduction in both in bladder spasms, but especially that involuntary contraction and loss of the medication around the catheter. So I'd say that's the most important piece.
Are there any patients in particular who would be especially good candidates for this drug?
The drug's indication is BCG unresponsive CIS. And so those are really the most appropriate candidates are people who have refused or are ineligible for radical cystectomy, and they have disease that's not responding to conventional intravesical BCG treatments. We have used off-label the drug in patients who have BCG unresponsive papillary only disease, so high-grade TA. There might have even been a couple of T1s. In my practice, I'm really hesitant to use any of these intravesical therapies for BCG unresponsive T1s. So I think that those are not ideal candidates. I think those patients should be treated with cystectomy. But I think for somebody who has a small amount of papillary, high-grade papillary TA disease, you know, it may be reasonable to consider as opposed to cystectomy. So I would say those are the best candidates. Obviously, the once every 90 days administration is ideal for people who are traveling long distances for their care. And this could be true at an academic center or in a rural community practice. You know, there's a lot of people who have to travel long distances. And so this would be a reasonable therapy to try in those patients in particular.
I'm glad he highlighted at the end just the forgiving treatment schedule. I think we don't have the power to do baseline characteristics to see which are, you know, good predictors of who will do well on this, but the forgiving treatment schedule is definitely a factor you have to consider, I think.
Are there any patients who you wouldn't use nadofaragene in, maybe with certain comorbidities?
I generally don't use it in people who have very high risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that need a radical cystectomy. So think high-grade T1s with concomitant CIS, lymphovascular invasion, maybe variant histology. Those are patients that need to have a radical cystectomy. I also generally don't use it in people who have a defunctionalized bladder, so poor capacity, poor compliance, people in whom I strongly suspect are just going to leak the drug around the catheter anyway, or they may have, you know, worsened bladder function as a result of additional intravesical therapy. I also tend to kind of usher those patients towards cystectomy. And I have not been using it in patients who don't have strictly defined BCG unresponsive disease. We follow that pretty closely. If they're exposed, then I generally put those patients on a clinical trial or more BCG.
Looking to the NCCN guidelines for patients who aren't candidates for BCG or are unresponsive, they know nadofaragene and nogabendegin alpha are options for the same patient population. And pembrolizumab has a big overlap with select patients. How would you select between these three drugs?
It's not a softball question. It's a tough question. First of all, I think the days for pembrolizumab monotherapy are kind of coming to an end. When we didn't have any other option and patients really didn't want cystectomy or further intravesical therapy, pembrolizumab monotherapy was a reasonable option. But now we have intravesical therapies that you just mentioned, two of them, nadofaragene and nogabendegin, that have demonstrated just as good, possibly maybe even slightly better efficacy in clinical trials and certainly better tolerability. With the two intravesical agents, we don't see any autoimmune-mediated systemic adverse events. So I think the risk-benefit ratio in general favors the two intravesical therapies. How to choose between those two, I think, is a very difficult task as well. In the one case, nadofaragene, it's given once every 90 days as a monotherapy. In the other case, nogabendegin, it's given in combination with BCG in the classic induction and maintenance paradigm. So if your practice is short on BCG, then you're likely not going to use nogabendegin. But that being said, nogabendegin is what I've called the leader in the clubhouse. They've come across the finish line with the highest complete response rate at a year in FDA population, which for them was 36%. So there's pros and cons to the administration and logistics, and, you know, 36% is 15% higher than 24%, which we observe for nadofaragene at a year. So there's questions potentially about comparative effectiveness. And I'm not saying that it's better, by the way. You know, I think we need to do the science to make that determination. But I could see how patients look at that and say, oh, I'd rather have that. Or I could see how patients look at nadofaragene and say, oh, I'd rather have that. So in my practice right now, I have the ability to prescribe both. I just got the ability to prescribe nogabendegin recently. I have a conversation with the patients and I just lay out the data for them. I lay out the risk-benefit ratios, what it takes to go on each of these therapies, and I let them choose.
I would just say that the real-world findings, even though our numbers are appear favorable. It's too early to say that really, but it certainly appears that in the real world, nadofaragene performed no worse than in clinical trials, which I think is promising. And we need extended follow-up and more patients, which I know are coming soon.
I think there are some instances, and maybe it's true in most instances, where the real world data doesn't measure up to the clinical trial data. And that's because the people we put in clinical trials are heavily vetted. They've made it through a litany of inclusion and exclusion criteria, and they just don't reflect the average patient that we see in the clinic. And so the idea behind this study was, well, how does this drug work for the average patient that's being seen in the clinic? And that was the intent of the study. I would hesitate to say, you know, even though there's a pretty large difference between 79% observed CR rate at 3 months in our real world study and the 51% observed in the phase three study, even though that's a large difference, I'm hesitant to say that it's better. Our data don't show that nadofaragene is more effective than we think. I think Jacob summarized it nicely by saying it's at least does not appear to be any worse, and that's really encouraging to see in a real world study.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.